Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries Goes Avant-Garde. Well, good morning, and that music does indeed let us all know it is time for another edition of Classical Discoveries Goes Avant-Garde. The time is 11 o'clock on Wednesday, July 20th, and you are tuned to WPRB, Princeton, New Jersey, community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Well, today, for the entire 2 hours, I am being joined by American composer Eve Baglarian, and we will be talking to her in just a few minutes after we listen to a brief selection. Thank you. You were just listening to Spherical Music by American composer E. Beglarian, as performed by marimbist Jane Boxall. Well, today we are indeed honored to have, for the entire 2 hours, American performer, composer, and audio producer E. Beglarian. According to Joseph Woodard of the Los Angeles Times, E. Beglarian is a humane, idealistic rebel and a musical sensualist whose music is on the eclectic and wide-open series of Enticements. She recently completed a 4.5-month journey down the Mississippi River by kayak and bicycle, and her chamber, choral, and orchestral music has been commissioned and widely performed by many performers and ensembles. She has also done much work in music theater. Well, Eve, thanks so much for coming in all this heat. It's great to have you here.
It's a delight, Marvin. Thank you.
And, well, I think one thing, you know, when you do an interview, you like to connect with the people out there and make some type of a common thread. And that's what we're going to start with. And it can't be more common than WPRB. Because, Eve, you were a DJ on this station when you were a student here at Princeton University. Now, first of all, let's, for people who are not aware, where was the station? It was not where it is now, of course.
Yeah. In the old days, it was in the basement of Holder Hall, which is one of the older dormitories up near Nassau Street.
Wow.
And so it's still in a basement, and it has a digital console, and it certainly did not. It had old pots, very big Bakelite pots that you turned.
Oh, gosh. Yes, yeah. Yes. I've seen some of the pictures.
Yeah. But other than that, it looks pretty much the same. It's really surprising.
I guess, some things don't change, I guess. Now, how long were you a DJ at PRB?
I think it was almost all 4 years of my undergraduate time. And then I stayed here for an extra year and commuted to Columbia for grad school. But I was here for an extra year.
You were still
and I
here.
Think I think I did shows then. So it would have been 5 years in the late 70s, early 80s.
Late 70s, early 80s. Well, you were not going to tell me this, so now I'm going to ask you because you were making me wait. What type of shows did you do and what kind of repertoire did you play?
Yes. Well, I had the early morning slot, the 6 to 10, you know, drive time slot.
Yeah.
And when I first started doing radio shows, I had this idea that I should try to emulate sort of the drive time slot of normal classical music stations, which is, you know, basically Vivaldi and, you know, Telemann and the stuff that'll wake you up in the morning.
John Philip Sousa.
And, but gradually I sort of became more liberal in my own policies. I mean, I was the classical director, so it was up to me to set the policies,
Oh,
right?
My gosh, yeah.
And one day, a classmate of mine, this guy named David Garfinkel, who was an absolutely wonderful guy, he came and he said, we're going to play the end of Rosenkavalier. You know, and I'm like, it's 7:30 in the morning. We can't play the end of Rosenkavalier at 7:30 in the morning. What are you talking about? And he's like, we're doing it. It's like the coolest piece of music on the planet, and we're doing it. And I really remember that so vividly because I was so sort of horrified. And, of course, it was totally fabulous. So,
sure. Well, that's one thing about here at WPRB is that it is so free, you know, what you do when you have an opportunity. Because I tell you, the kind of show that I've done here now, beginning in my 15th year, I could not do on other stations, especially in the morning.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and for me, it was a wonderful learning experience as well, because basically to fill up, you know, 4 hours of drive time, and there were periods. There was one summer where I think I stayed for the summer and did, you know, that show 5 days a week.
And you were doing it, wow, now that's...
You know, so that was a lot of music. And it was right when New World Records came out with that.
Oh, sure.
200, the first 200, I guess they would have been LPs in those days, you know, for the bicentennial or whatever. So there was all this really great music that came out of that series. It was wonderful. And it was a great education for me because I'd say, well, let's try this. You know, it looks good. So.
And one thing which is great, too, is that you have a good range. Of course, the internet wasn't there yet, but you did have a very good range, you know, with the wattage to get out to. Did it get down to Philadelphia back?
Yeah.
You see that.
I mean, it was a 50,000 watt station.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of power. And now, did you do other shows at any time?
Well, I did do a Sunday afternoon show where I would play more new music and opera, mm-hmm. you know, on that show. And mm-hmm. then there was a period where I got really obsessed with disco. And so I did a disco show as
this
well.
This is not what you wanted to tell me before. So disco, so this is what at the time we were talking about. So what were we hearing like at that time, the Bee Gees? And
yeah, it was like, you know, the efflorescence of disco.
Yeah, Saturday Night Fever.
But
yeah.
As electronic music, it was definitely unbelievable. You know, Giorgio Moroder is a genius.
Yeah, sure,
and so
sure.
I was into it. I needed to learn that stuff too. So
wonderful. Well, before we go back to your early years, let's relate your work to PRB to some other radio work you said you were doing.
Yeah, well, before I came to Princeton, the summer before I came to Princeton, mm-hmm. I had a part-time job at KUSC in Los mm-hmm. Angeles,
okay.
which is an NPR station
yeah.
now. I think, I don't know yeah. if it was in those yeah. days. And so it was the campus radio station of the University of Southern California. But it was professionally run. It wasn't a student-run thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I came in contact with this really conservative idea about what morning music is supposed
to
be.
Oh, my gosh.
And the guy who was the sort of artistic advisor for KUSC at that time was a man named Abram Chasins, who probably...
Yeah? That's right.
Yeah, he was like from a really earlier generation.
That's right.
Really, really conservative. And he had been involved, I believe, in the artistic direction of WQXR in its early days. And
yes,
so,
you
know, there was this lineage of unbelievably mainstream, classical, you know, tight ideas about what music programming was supposed to be like that I sort of learned and then jettisoned once I got here.
Yeah, that's what, because I basically, when I started doing my program, I started with kind of mixing the eclectic with the not so eclectic. And I have to say, that lasted about 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just said, well, the stuff that people were reacting to was the very eclectic stuff. So why should I do everything what everyone else does?
Right.
And since then, I haven't done anything anybody else does.
Yeah.
So because of what's fun, you know, when you get here, as you know, Eve, is that when you get a recording, like you were referring to almost the way the New World stuff, I get a recording one day, and if I have a show the next, I can put it on the air at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what's so special about this station. Just you have your feelings and your passions and you pursue them here on the air.
Yeah.
And that's what this is all about. Well, let's now go back before some of you, at the very beginning. When did you decide you wanted to have a career in music and what were your early exposures like in music?
Well, I grew up in a musical family. My father was trained as a composer. My mother was a pianist and harpsichordist and mm-hmm. organist. And so music was just sort of in the air.
Mm.
By the time I was a teenager, my father was more an administrator. He was the dean of the School of Performing Arts at the University of Southern California.
Oh, okay.
And so so I was surrounded by music all the time. And I learned to read music around the same time I learned to read. And we took piano lessons, and then I switched to violin, and then to cello, because mm-hmm. I met Gregor Piatigorsky had a huge crush on him when I was 11, and he was a really wonderful, wonderful character.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I sort of did music as just sort of part of the air I breathed, and mm-hmm. took it for granted, very much so. And I came to Princeton thinking I was going to do brain science. Neurobiology, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And I got here, and within about a month, I realized, oh no, this is not going to work. You know, like if it's not in the air, I'm going to have to generate it myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I very quickly switched to music. But the way the music theory works at Princeton is that it's a year-long course.
Mm-hmm.
So because I hadn't taken music 101 or whatever it is, I don't remember the numbering system, in the fall of my freshman year, I had to wait until the fall of my sophomore year.
Oh, okay.
And in a way, it was a really wonderful thing because that whole first year, I took a lot of math and science courses. I did history and philosophy of science. I did all sorts of things that I wouldn't have done if I had gone directly into music. So it was delightful.
Right.
I mean, I loved being at Princeton, and I felt really lucky because I switched to music, and it turned out, here's this fabulous music department. I hadn't chosen Princeton because of its fabulous music department.
Right. Who were some of the people you studied with back, you know?
Well,
you
in those
here.
Days, there was Jim Randall, Milton Babbitt, a guy named Claudio Spies.
Oh, yeah, sure, I
know
him.
All
sure,
these,
sure.
And it was a really exciting and wonderful place. And it was a small department, so I took graduate courses, you know, by the time I was a junior. So it was very open and very, and I really was able to go deeply.
That's great. Well, that's great. Let's talk about composition now.
Yeah.
What were your first pieces like, and when did they get down on paper, as they say?
Well, when I first decided to switch to music, I didn't know what I wanted to do in music. And I thought maybe being a conductor would be a cool thing. That was my thought.
Yeah.
And so I started writing music basically with the idea that it would teach me how to be a better conductor. Because if I worked with music from the inside, it would give me insights that would be helpful to me as an interpreter. And I think that's a good thing, because I think if I had started out saying, I'm going to be a composer now, I would have been panicked at the moxie of that, or the arrogance of that attempt, you know?
Yeah.
But because I was starting out composing without any idea that I was a composer, I was writing music. I wasn't a composer. And then, of course, I fell in love with the process of composing. And so I sort of fell into being a composer.
Interesting. Now, what were your early pieces like?
I think they were the standard student thing, in the sense that they tended to be solo pieces or duo pieces, you know, small ensemble pieces, short. In those days, you know, it was still the high point of Eurocentric 12-tone.
Yeah, that's what that's, yeah.
You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. And so, you know, that's what I learned how to do. But along with that, I also started doing computer music. I think one of the first pieces I wrote was for the, you know, the mainframe IBM computer with punch cards and the like.
So you got into this
almost
type
right
of composition. That was my next question. That was when you got into that.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to go now to a piece which is unbelievably exciting. I have to say it, and I heard it this morning, and unbelievable. It's titled The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. It dates from 1994 and was commissioned by the Philadelphia Relâche Ensemble. Eve, tell us a bit more about the work and the various types of influences that are in this. I mean, it's just an incredible way, I think, to jump into your music. And I mean jump literally, because it really does jump.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
Tell us about it.
The piece is based on three aphorisms by William Blake, who's like one of my favorite guys. And the first aphorism, it comes from a book called The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. And the first aphorism is, opposition is true friendship. And so the way the first movement works is that I take the clave pattern of Latin music, the standard clave pattern, and I offset it metrically so that you're implying these conflicting ideas of where the downbeat is, because of where the clave pattern tells you it is, and they're all fighting with one another.
That's so exciting.
So opposition is true friendship.
Yeah.
And the second aphorism is energy is eternal delight, and it sort of turns into a party piece for a while. And then the third one is you never know what is enough unless you know what is more than enough. And that piece is built on the whole tone fragment that is also the melody of a Bach chorale, which is called Es ist genug, which means it is enough in German. So it all sort of connects.
One thing I found very interesting, even, we're going to talk about this more in your music later on, is that you have taken kind of as a point of departure early music that is, I've noticed, but the Hildegard and then with the Handel Messiah. Is this just, did it just happen, or have you always had an interest in early music, or?
Well, I think at a certain point, the overblown 19th century symphonic, you know, mainstream classical music thing sort of begins to pall. After you've heard the Rhenish Symphony 460 times, you really don't need to hear it anymore, you know?
Thank you very much. I agree with you 100%.
So early music and contemporary music, I think, have tremendous commonality.
Yeah, that's
you know, so my heart really lies with Machaut and Monteverdi on the one hand, and, Steve Reich. And
that's what my show is all about. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, let's listen now to this incredible piece by my guest, Eve Baglarian. We hear vocalist Lisa Bielava, who has been a guest on this program, and she sings a half-spoken and half-sung. And we also hear the ensemble. Is that the Mata Ensemble? And quite an interesting, I guess, distinguished group of new music people on this ensemble, including Eleanor Sandreski and Seth Jossel on electric guitar. But let's listen to this music right now. Once again, this is The Marriage of Heaven and Hell by my guest, Eve Baglarian.
Opposition is true friendship. Opposition is true friendship. Opposition is true friendship. Opposition is true friendship. Thank you.
Thank you.
You were just listening to music by Eve Baglarian, my guest here in the WPRB studio until 1 p.m. That was The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. You heard vocalist Lisa Bielava along with the Mata Ensemble, a New World Records compact disc totally devoted to the music of Eve Baglarian, and we will be listening probably to another selection from this CD a little later on today's program. Well, Eve, welcome back. That was really, I think, a wonderful introduction to your music, music which people can really, I guess, really get into it. It's hard not to.
Thank you.
You know, when you listen to that. But let's go on now. We will be discussing some of the various projects you have been involved with in just a little bit. However, before we do, describe just in very general terms the importance of the spoken word to you and your music.
Yes. In a way, I think my interest in spoken word grew out of my day job, the work that I used to do to support myself as a composer before I was self-supporting as a composer.
Yeah.
And that was producing and directing audiobooks, which I started
very
doing in the early 80s and sort of retired from that in the late 90s and have been composing full-time ever since. But during that period, you know, I produced a huge number of audiobooks and was dealing with the sound of people's voices, not so much as music in that setting, but it influenced,
kind of was a stepping stone in a way. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we have that one influence on one end, and now we have your Armenian heritage in another. How important is your Armenian heritage to you and your music? Because we're going to hear a piece in a few minutes that is quite very strongly inspired by that.
Yes. In a way, my father was Armenian. My mother was not. She's English, Irish, and Scottish. And my father was of the generation of immigrants who sort of became an American whole hog, you know, and sort of didn't teach his children the language, didn't bring us up in the culture. Mm-hmm. I think I maybe went to an Armenian church service once in my life.
Okay.
You know, he became an American. He really didn't hold on to his roots in that way. And so it wasn't until after he died that I really, really immersed myself in Armenian culture. And I sort of felt like it was a way of getting insight into an aspect of my father that my father himself hadn't really shared with me. Although towards the end of his life, when he was sick, he talked a lot about being Armenian and his childhood and stuff like that. And so I really felt like it was time for me to learn something about this. And of course, you go to Armenian music and it's this really marvelous stuff.
Yeah. Komitas and all those
people. Yes, and all the traditions and the funny liminal place that it has between East and West. You really can hear the geography of Armenia in the music itself.
Yeah, that's right.
It's really powerful.
It surely is. And the next piece we're going to hear goes into that influence quite heavily. You just brought a brand new CD of your composition, I Will Not Be Sad in This World. Now, I have another recording of this piece for flute, but you have one now. This is on bass flute. And remembering the tape part of this piece, which I do know and have heard, combined with the bass flute, combined with the richness of Armenian music, this is going to be something I think very special. Tell us about this work we're going to hear.
Yeah, the piece, the title is the name of a song by Sayat Nova, who's a very important person claimed by Georgians, Armenians, Turks. You know, everybody fights over who he gets to be, you know, what his nationality is.
Yeah.
And I think the answer is all of the above. And And I was commissioned by the marvelous flutist, Maria Martin, and she recorded the first recording of this piece on alto flute. And I love the recording, and it's really great. But I received this recording from an Italian flute player named Manuel Zuria that I just think is marvelous. He really, there's something someplace he's going with it, the bass flute that I'm really, really loving.
So it's his bass flute and...
And pre-recorded electronics. And the electronics are made from me singing and then processed. So all of the sonic material of the tape part is my voice.
My voice. Well, we're going to hear this now. Music by my guest, Eve Baglarian, here on WPRB.
Thank you.
You were just listening to music by my guest, Eve Baglarian, and that was titled, I Will Not Be Sad in This World. The bass flutist was Manuel Zuria, a brand new recording of that composition, which featured my guest's singing voice on the tape. Very beautiful, Eve. I enjoyed that very, very much. And best of luck with the new recording Let's now go to another work of yours. In fact, this also has a bit of the Armenian heritage in this also. And this is titled, I Am Writing to You from a Far Off Country. And this dates from 2006. Now, this is actually a piece which you and the great cellist Maya Beiser collaborated. And did you work together when you were writing this?
Yes, very much so. The way the piece came into being was that Maya brought me this poem by the Belgian surrealist poet Henri Michaux, which has the same name as the piece, I Am Writing to You from a Far Off Country. And it's a series of 12 letters written to an unknown person that are rather surrealist and mysterious and beautiful letters. And she asked me to work with her to make a piece for this poetry. And so we worked together very, very closely. And originally, I was going to write the piece where each of the 12 sections would be from a different far-off country, so that I would work with world music from 12 different places.
Oh, yeah.
And including, of course, the United States, because it's a far-off country if you're somewhere else. then I decided that would be like way too Disney, We Are the World, or, you know, It's a Small World After All or something. And so I decided not to go that way. And so instead, I started with a core of melodic material that was Armenian. And the different sections, there are sort of three different places where that Armenian music gets played out, using compositional techniques from different places. And the section we're going to listen to now is the African section. It's basically using North African compositional techniques, but dealing with Armenian melodic material. So the two get conflated in some way. And then the later sections go to Indonesia, and I end up with Indonesian compositional techniques of one kind or another.
So we're going to hear Maya Beiser, our cellist, and she also narrates in this also. And the vocalist is Alexandra Montano, and this is letters 5 through 7 of Eve Baglarian's I Am Writing to You from a Far Off Country, a Koch International Classics compact disc.
I'm writing to you from the end of the world. You must realize this. Often the trees tremble. We collect the leaves. They have a ridiculous number of veins. What for? There's nothing between the leaves and the tree anymore. And we go off troubled. Could life not continue on earth without wind? Or must everything tremble always? Always. There are also subterranean disturbances, and in the house as well, like rages which might confront you, like stern beings who would like to extract confessions. see nothing, except what is of so little import to see. Nothing. And yet, we tremble. Why? All of us women here live with tightened throats. Do you know, although I'm very young, in other times I was younger still, and my companions were also. What does that mean? There is surely something horrible in it. And in other times, when, as I've already told you, we were younger still, we were afraid. Someone might have taken advantage of our confusion. Someone might have said to us, "Look, we're going to bury you. The moment has arrived." We were thinking, "It's true. We could just as well be buried this evening, if it is definitely stated that this is the moment." And we didn't dare run too much. Out of breath, at the end of a race, to arrive in front of a ditch all prepared, and no time to say a word. Not a breath. Tell me, just what is the secret about this? Thank you.